Good morning. My name is Marty Tankleff. I am a New York State exoneree that just passed the 10-year anniversary mark of me being free from crimes for which I was innocent of and I was wrongfully convicted and served almost 18 years for.
You're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast spreading awareness of wrongful convictions and issues with the justice system. I'm Brooke, and I'm here with my co-host, DeMarco. Happy New Year! It's good to talk to you again.
Happy New Year's to you. How's your year starting off?
My year is going pretty good. I wanted to give a huge thank you to Melly and Jennifer. They both have given us really generous donations, and they are offsetting our costs for the Innocence Conference. So that's really exciting.
Wow, that is exciting. Thank you. Thank y'all. Melly, Jennifer, thank you each.
Did you make any New Year's resolutions?
I didn't.
I made kind of a goal. My goal was just to be more organized so that way I spend less time like playing catch up.
New Year's, I stayed at home because it was really cold outside. So I stayed at home reading.
I did the same thing. Do you watch The Ball Drop?
In New York Times, I want to be there one day.
You know, I used to say that, and then I went to New York, and I was on Times Square, like, right after all the Broadway shows let out, and there were so many people I couldn't move. I was so, like, overwhelmed, because I'm from a small town.
Yeah, and for me to be in prison, and I've always watched The Ball Drop, but, you know, that's a goal of mine, that I want to be there.
You live in Central Time, so do you watch The Ball Drop at 11?
Yep.
I grew up in Central Time, so I would watch The Ball Drop at 11. And when I first moved to Eastern Time, I was so excited because I got to see The Ball Drop at midnight. It was amazing.
I bet it was.
So we're going to talk about today's sponsor. Today's sponsor is ZipRecruiter, which is super relevant because we're looking for a part-time assistant to add to our team in accordance with my New Year's resolution of not overextending myself. I actually just posted the position on ZipRecruiter and I timed it. It took me 8 minutes to post it, and that included resetting my password because I had forgotten it. A fresh new year has begun. If you're setting new goals for your business, you'll find it's extremely difficult to reach them without the right people on your team. ZipRecruiter has transformed how you go about finding the right fit.
ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. Then ZipRecruiter actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invite them to apply. They even review every application to identify the top candidate, so you never miss a great match.
No wonder 80% of employers who post job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/actual.
That's ZipRecruiter.com/actual. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/actual.
ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Our guest today is Marty Tankleff, who is maybe one of the most well-known exonerees in the U.S., I've seen documentaries that talk about his case. He does public speaking. He's been on TV. I was looking at his website, martytankleff.org, and it's an incredible wealth of knowledge with court documents and corresponding media pieces, a blog, and a lot of other things. I highly suggest you check it out. Did you meet Marty last year at the Innocence Conference, DeMarco?
No, I didn't. And the thing about it, it was so many people there, and, you know, it was like, wow, I was overwhelmed last year, but, you know, since I was with the big fella, Anthony DiPippo, you know, he talked a lot about him because that's a good friend of his, but, you know, unfortunately, I didn't get to meet Marty.
Yeah, I feel really full of gratitude because it was Marty that suggested I attend the Innocence Conference in 2017. If he hadn't made that suggestion, I would have never met you, and Actual Innocence wouldn't have gained this amazing perspective that you bring to it. So I made it a point to meet Marty, and I took him an Actual Innocence coffee mug. So I have a picture with Marty. I think I'll use it for the cover for this episode. Before we play the interview, I wanted to mention that during the interview that the crime isn't described in detail. I can't imagine it would be comfortable for even an extremely well-adjusted person like Marty to share this kind of experience. So I'm just going to share a few details. They aren't extremely graphic, but they definitely are tragic.
I believe he used the phrase, "I came home to a nightmare."
Yeah, and unfortunately for Marty, the nightmare was that his parents had been murdered. His mother's body was found on her bedroom floor. She'd been beaten and stabbed, and her throat had been slit. And his father was found in the opposite side of the house, and he had also been beaten and stabbed, but he was alive. His father was taken to the hospital, and he survived in a coma for about a month before he succumbed to his injuries. So I just wanted the listeners to have that information during Marty's telling of his story.
Marty Tankleff. I'm hoping to meet him in Memphis, but unfortunately he won't be there. But, you know, hopefully I get to meet him in the future. But here's Marty Tankleff.
I grew up in an affluent area in the Port Jefferson Village, basically, in the North Shore of Suffolk County. Life was great up until I turned 17, when my life changed completely.
We have a high listenership in the UK and in Australia. Can you give us a mini geography lesson? We just interviewed Anthony DePippo and Jeff Deskovic, and they're also both from New York. Can you tell us where that is in relationship to where they were? Do you know that?
Sure. So if you look at a picture of the United States and there's New York, there's an island that branches off to the right, or I guess you could say the east from Manhattan. That island contains Brooklyn, Queens, Nassau, and Suffolk. The north shore of it is closer to Connecticut, and the south shore is closer to the ocean. I live in Suffolk County, which is part of Long Island, as do people who live in Brooklyn and Queens. They live on Long Island, even though they like to say they don't.
Did you have a big family growing up?
I was an only child, but I had a half-sister who was married. She had two kids. My cousins had children. So it was a pretty big family, not a lot of kids.
What did you like to do growing up?
So I live in a very nice area where we like to go to the beach. We like to go fishing, spending time on boats. I like to travel, cook, spend time with my friends. In many ways, it was the normal average childhood for kids on Long Island, I would say.
You said your life changed forever. What do you feel comfortable telling us about that?
So my father was engaged in business with a man by the name of Jerry Stuerman. And he loaned Jerry Stuerman probably over $500,000. And in the summer of 1988, the business relationship deteriorated so much that Jerry had threatened to commit violent acts against my father. My father started to demand some of the money back. And on September 7th, I woke up to a nightmare. And that was the life-changing moment for me.
And so I read that you called emergency services, which is the right thing to do. How long was it after you made that call that you started to become a suspect?
So according to the testimony of everybody, it was almost instantaneously. And that instantaneous of me being a suspect was from a gentleman by the name of Detective K. James McCready, who we later learned had a relationship with my father's business partner, who we later learned was not supposed to be on duty that day, was not the designated homicide detective, but somehow he was the first homicide detective to arrive at the scene dressed in a suit and tie when he was supposed to be working at his construction site. This is the same lead detective who, after I was found guilty, went into business with my half-sister. So the people who benefited financially from my conviction was my half-sister and the lead detective.
Your half-sister from your mother or from your father?
From my father. Father's first marriage.
Can you describe yourself as a 17-year-old? What did you look like physically?
Skinny, scrawny, 140 pounds, Some have said I look like a very young, Christopher from Tony Soprano, from The Sopranos, with the big hair, the pompadour, but 5'8", 120 pounds.
So very intimidating.
Oh, yeah, extremely. You know, very, very small. No, I wasn't like 6'4", 220 pounds. I wasn't a football player, nothing like that at all.
You were a 17-year-old kid, and your biggest support, your parents weren't able to be there with you. Who were you able to turn to for support? Did you have an attorney? Did you have someone to look to?
Actually, no. The morning of September 7th, the law enforcement isolated me from everyone. So when family tried to get near me, I was told they were either told I either wasn't there, or they were told that they can come somewhere else. So there was a pattern of deceit and dishonesty to keep me away from family and friends. And I did not have a lawyer either.
Well, and we talked to Jeff and Anthony, and they both were telling us about, you know, being questioned and a polygraph and feeling like they were forced into saying what they were saying. Did you have an experience similar to that?
Absolutely. I mean, I even offered to take a polygraph. And it was denied. Subsequently, though, as part of my post-conviction proceeding, myself, the getaway driver, and another witness were all polygraphed. We've all passed. And each of our test results were actually submitted to the post-conviction hearing court. But essentially, the way the interrogations work, and I think this is really consistent in every false confession case, is interrogators don't care about the truth. They go into an interrogation with the sole purpose of getting incriminating statements, whether truthful or not, and they don't leave that interrogation room till they have what they call the confession, even if it doesn't match up to the physical evidence. And if it doesn't match up to the physical evidence, they try to kind of, what I would say, is formulate things around it afterwards.
When this crime happened, how long after the crime happened, when were you?
Immediately, pretty much. And you'll find in most interrogations, that's what happens. You know, law enforcement will latch onto people as quickly as possible, isolate people, good cop, bad cop, conduct interrogations. And for a lot of people, it's very, very difficult for them to understand why anyone, especially innocent people, will confess falsely. I'll just give you two brief stories. I was at a CLE where a false confession expert was telling a story where an individual was accused of a rape and murder. He was bald. During his interrogation, the cop said, "We have your hair at the crime scene. Just tell us you did it." In his mind, he said, "I'm bald. There's no way they can have my hair at the crime scene." He confessed. Okay? So then when people say, well, you know, how easy is it to confess to a crime you didn't commit? So I ask, generally I do this when I'm in a large audience, and I say, okay, how many people have siblings? 50% of the hands get raised. I said, do you remember when you were a kid, the parents went out, and both of you were home, and somebody broke a lamp, or somebody broke something in the house, and your parents come home and say, we're not going out for ice cream until somebody tells us who broke the lamp? How many of you in the room who didn't break the lamp said you broke the lamp just to go out for ice cream? I got another 50% of people said, yes. I go, you just confessed to something you didn't do. And then you get the whole room gets silent. I go, multiply that by 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times. When you're an adult, when you're in police custody, when you're basically told, you're never leaving this room till you tell us what we want to hear. And all of a sudden everybody goes, okay, I get it now.
Yeah, I'm the person who's not doing anything wrong, but if a police car pulls behind me, then I get all nervous, even though I'm not doing anything wrong. I just feel guilty because I'm in the situation. But yeah, that's a great analogy.
There was a handwritten statement or a partial statement that was written up by Detective K. James McCready. The first time I ever saw that statement was at the Huntley hearing, which was years later.
Got it.
So, and police practice experts who have actually looked at that knew that statement wasn't written that day, the day of the interrogation. And everybody said, well, how do you know that? They said, ask anybody in law enforcement if one of the first paragraphs of a statement is the Miranda warnings. If you can't get a suspect who signed the Miranda warnings portion of the statement, why would you continue writing a statement out if you can't even get past that first paragraph? The statement McCready wrote up was like 2.5, almost 3 pages long. And in my case, Suffolk County had a policy of procedures in place that they chose to completely ignore, where they could have electronically recording every single thing that took place in the interrogation room. They chose not to, though. And I've said this for 20 years. Had they just followed their own rules and regulations, I never would have been gone to jail. I never would have served almost 18 years in prison. And everyone would have known what took place in that interrogation room. And I think that's consistent in every single interrogation. When they have the availability to electronically record the interview and the interrogation, everyone is protected. And we're not talking about, you know, after 6 hours of being questioned, and they do that last hour. From the moment the first question is asked, every single thing should be recorded.
So as a 17-year-old, did you get an appointed attorney? Were you able to hire an attorney? How did that work out?
Yeah, my family was able to, we found an attorney and we hired one to represent me after I was charged.
How did you feel like that went? I mean, did they do a good job?
So I am friendly with my trial attorney. He's acknowledged that he made mistakes. But in most wrongful conviction cases, defense lawyers are at a disadvantage. No matter how much investigations they do, no matter how much of a good job they do, they're going up against the largest and most powerful law firm in the county, which is the DA's office or the prosecutor's office. In my case, Bob did a good job. He didn't do a great job because obviously he lost. But there's a lot of things that he could have done differently. But I also can't blame him for things that we didn't know went on. We didn't, you know, we weren't aware that McCready was showing bloody crime scene photos to witnesses to manipulate their testimony. Or witnesses were being told to testify a certain way. All these things were going on, which, you know, we weren't aware of back then.
Is it difficult for you to talk about this, reliving this?
Some aspects are, but you know, for me, I find this with a lot of exonerees, is that if we don't talk about it, it's going to happen time and time again, time and time again. And we need to be able to educate the public, the law enforcement, the judiciary, and prosecutors. If they don't see what went wrong in some of the old wrongful conviction cases, how are we going to stop it from happening in future wrongful conviction cases?
How long did it take between the time that you were charged and your trial?
September 7th, 1988 was when I was arrested. June 28th, 1990 was when I was convicted.
So you're 17 and you've been charged with this terrible trauma and your parents aren't there. So during that time, who were your people? Like, who did you turn to?
My entire family supported me except my half-sister. So my mother's sisters and their family, my father's brother, his family, friends. Some friends were willing to support me publicly. Others were very intimidated because law enforcement had gotten to some of their families and said, don't support Marty. But since then, all of my friends that I was actually, that were intimidated, have come forward, have spoken to me and apologized and explained why they did what they did.
And how did you feel? Like, as a 17-year-old, I was worried about, you know, do I have enough gas to put in my car so I can go out on Friday night? Like, what was your emotional state?
Well, I was brought up to have faith in the system. And I felt the system would never incarcerate an innocent person. And that faith was destroyed on June 20th, 1990.
That's how I felt, too.
And I've said this publicly so many times. If it could happen to me, a young white man, affluent area, retained counsel, investigators, How often does it happen to somebody in minority communities, people who can't afford lawyers, people who can't afford investigators, people who don't have family or friends? We see it all too often. And that's why so many of us in the wrongful conviction movement consistently want to testify or educate people to make an example that it just doesn't happen to one segment of the community. Does it happen to, you know, more of a percentage in one segment of the community? Absolutely. But wrongful convictions do not discriminate. It doesn't matter if you're white, black, male, female, gay, straight, or transgender. The system doesn't care. There's no discrimination. They will convict you no matter what. And, you know, when politics plays a role in it, it can even become worse. When the media gets involved, and that can even be a more damaging effect. And what I mean by that is I actually had this, I brought this up recently. I was speaking to a group of about 50 people, an older group of people, not college kids. And I said, if there was a murder in your backyard and the police announced someone was arrested, would you be satisfied with that? 95% of the room said yes. I said, what if I told you they arrested the wrong person? Everyone in the room said, we didn't think of that. I go, that's the problem. We as a society accept when we're told someone was arrested, not the right person. We need to change our thinking to know that the right person was arrested. I would rather take a year or 2 years to have the right person arrested than have the wrong person arrested and have the system just go downhill.
We do trivia at the beginning of our shows usually. And last week's trivia was about New York, and it was talking about of the people who'd been exonerated in New York. In 10 of those cases, the real perpetrator was discovered later on. And in nine of those 10 cases, that perpetrator had gone on to kill other people or to rape other people. So, yeah, it's absolutely worth it to take the time to find the right person.
You know, let's say I get two cases. Jeff Deskovic's case is one of them, and the Central Park Jogger case. You know, both those cases where the real culprits committed additional crimes, and they were violent crimes. It is better the system functions, society benefits, when we actually pursue and prosecute the right person. If we incarcerate an innocent person, the guilty parties remain free, commit additional crimes, and we as a society become victims. And in reality, the prosecutor's office becomes the most, they actually victimize us even more because they have a duty to charge and prosecute the right person. When they fail in their duty to charge and prosecute the right person, they actually victimize us even worse than anyone else.
So what was your trial like for you?
Wow, that's kind of hard to like describe. I mean, think about you're 18 years old, on trial for your life. Some of it I remember, some of it I don't remember. But it really is a difficult kind of experience. And I think anybody who's 18, you just don't think it's a reality. You know, every day we're just like, this can't be happening. This is not real.
Was it a jury trial?
It was a jury trial.
And do you remember how long it lasted?
Approximately 4 weeks of jury selection, 8 weeks of trial. And I do remember one of the weirdest things for my trial was is that when we used to go out for lunch, a lot of times there was a park near the courthouse. The jurors would be having lunch at like one picnic table, and me and my family would all be sitting at the next picnic table. And I was like, okay, this can't be real. Like, you know, the jurors have to see just beyond, you know, what's going on in the courtroom and just see like, okay, if my family is supporting me, doesn't that send a message?
Where were you at during your trial? Like, where were you located?
I was living in Nassau County with my family. So I got out on bail after about a month of being incarcerated.
Did you testify on your own behalf?
I did.
What was that like?
My philosophy was innocent men want to testify and tell their story and explain their position.
Did you feel tripped up like by the prosecution? Like, were they asking you questions that you there was no right answer to? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like,
I, you know, honestly, I don't even remember. Like, you know, it was about 2 days of, you know, it was 2 days of testimony.
What evidence did they use to convict you? What key evidence?
The only evidence that they really had, or that they said they had, was a confession that the cops said I made to them. There was no fingerprints. There was no blood evidence. There was no hair evidence. There was absolutely nothing connecting me to the crime.
What do you remember about the day that the jury came back?
Not so much the guilty verdict. What I remember is being escorted over to the county jail. And I remember going to the clothing room. And I remember the officer saying, what are you doing here? And I just look at him and I go, well, why else would I be here? And I remember him saying, there's no way they found you guilty. We all know you're innocent. That's what I remember.
What's the name of the room that you said? I'm sorry, I didn't.
The clothing room where you have to, like, I had to turn my suit over and they put you in a prison clothing.
How long did the jury deliberate?
8 days.
8 days?
8 days.
So after you were taken into custody, where did you go?
I was housed at the Suffolk County Jail. Then we had post-conviction hearings for a few months. Then on October 5th, I was sentenced. And then maybe it was about a month later, I went from the Suffolk County Jail up to Downstate Correction Facility in Fishkill, New York, which is a reception center in New York.
So as a affluent white man, what was prison like for you?
Horrible. You know, prison is not a fun place to be for anybody. The interesting thing is that so many people knew I was innocent that I think I was looked upon a little bit differently. And I think that seems to be I don't want to say a pattern, but my experience by talking to exonerees is that some exonerees had a different experience in that people who knew who they were, who had filed their cases, knew they were innocent and supported them. I was also given very good advice early on. In reception, I was told, don't become a snitch. Don't get involved in gambling. Don't do drugs. And don't get involved in homosexuality. And spend as much time in the law library. And I followed every one of those pieces of advice. And I worked in the law library probably 12 to 14 years, helping myself and other people as well.
And how much time did you have?
I was given a sentence of 50 years to life.
Mm. And when they say 50 years to life, what does that mean? You serve a minimum of 50 years?
In New York, you would serve a minimum of 50 years before your first eligible parole date. My first eligible parole date, if I remember correctly, was October 5th of 2040.
And what was it like? What were some of the things that you did to keep you focused?
So I used to have a mental philosophy that I wasn't living in prison. I was temporarily residing there. That as an innocent man, I wasn't going to die in prison. And I took advantage of whatever I could there. So when the college program was available, I took college classes. When the college program ceased in the prison I was in, I started working in the law library. I wasn't working in the law library, I worked in the general library. And then, you know, the last jail I was in, which was great, mental correctional facility, I got a job in the law library there pretty quickly, and I spent 90% of my time there.
So working in the law library, is that what started the ball rolling towards your exoneration? Like, how did that start?
I think it started when I was at Auburn Correctional Facility and I met an individual who said something to the effect, he goes, it's the easiest thing the system does is incarcerate an innocent person, and the most difficult thing is to exonerate that innocent person. He said, the system found a way for you to be convicted. You'll have to find a way to be exonerated. And that gentleman just showed me how to use the law books and how to read things. And I just started reading and reading and reading. And I had amazing lawyers. I mean, the appeal lawyers that I had, and some of them are still working on my case, were just amazing. They, you know, even when the New York State appeal lawyers couldn't work on my case, they offered to help out. And then I got lawyers from D.C. And then years later, the New York lawyers that stopped working on my case, they came back on and continued working with my case. So at one point, I probably had 6 or 7 different law firms working on my case.
Well, and I wanted to ask, I read that the mothership, the New York Innocence Project, was established in 92, which was, did they have anything to do with your case at that time, or was it too early for them? How did that work?
No, the only thing the Innocence Project did is they essentially were consultants on my case, and they also wrote an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, in 2007. Because I was represented by counsel, they didn't represent me.
Did you have any family or friends who came to visit you while you were locked up?
Everybody, all my family came to see me except my half-sister. And I had a decent amount of friends come to see me as well.
Are you and your half-sister on speaking terms now?
No, we haven't spoken since, wow, 1989.
Dang. It's a long time.
You think about it. She benefited financially from my conviction. She went into business with the lead detective. That's a sore subject.
Can you tell us about the path that led to your exoneration? Like, what was the evidence and what, you know, legal process you went through?
Sure. So over the years, the appellate lawyers were litigating my case through the court system. And we finally got to a point where we said, what's never been done before? And at that point, I started looking for private investigators. And I found one by the name of Jay Salpeter, who said, if you're innocent, hire me. He said, if you're not, don't waste either of our time. I said, I'm innocent. Where do I sign? So Jay conducted an investigation. Essentially, what he did was he started from Jerry Stuerman. Jerry Stuerman's son, Todd, was a drug dealer. He started branching out, finding all of Todd's criminal associates. He found an individual by the name of Glenn Harris, who, when he went to see Glenn Harris, he said, I've been waiting for this day for whatever it was, 12 or 13 years, whatever it was, when Jay went to see him. Jay says, what do you mean? He goes, I was a getaway driver that night. And essentially that opened Pandora's box. That just led from one witness to another to another. Mm-hmm. When we started developing a body of evidence that we felt was sufficient to establish my innocence, we went to the DA's office in the summer of 2004 and gave them an opportunity to investigate everything. We said, we're going to give you 45 days. If you don't do anything in 45 days, we're going to file a 440 motion, which is a post-conviction motion in New York. On the 45th day, I think is when they went to see the first witness. We said, screw it, we're going to file the motion. We filed the motion. In 2005, we started hearings, and we had 18 months of hearings. And the final witness of the hearing was Joseph Creedon's son. Joseph Creedon was one of the people we identified publicly as being one of the murderers, and his own son testified as the last witness that his father confessed to him that he committed the murders.
Dang.
And on St. Patrick's Day, I think it was 2017, the judge ruled against me.
What was that like?
It was devastating, but when you read the judge's decision, you kind of felt that, you know, was this judge sitting in the same courtroom as everyone else? And when we appealed that decision to the appellate division, and they completely agreed with me on everything. It was like vindication. It was finally like, you know, somebody saw the light. Somebody finally saw the truth here. And on December 27, 2007, I was freed. And I've been free ever since.
And what I see your name all the time in the news. I actually had a sponsor once and they were like, you know, take this online course that looks interesting to you. And there you were. Like, I see your name everywhere advocating for this cause. So what are you doing now? Like, what does your life look like now?
So I graduated from law school. I've taken the uniform bar exam. I'm seeking admission in New York, New Jersey, and D.C. I'm going to be teaching at Georgetown University with my friend Mark Howard this coming semester. By the end of the year, hopefully I'll be teaching a class at Torah Law School. I regularly lecture at colleges and universities. I get invitations to speak at the, I've spoken at the NYPD. I've spoken at the former Suffolk County Police Commissioner's classes. I've testified before the New York State Senate Assembly, the New York City Council, and hopefully, you know, in a year's time, things will get even better. Maybe I'll walk my first exoneree out of prison.
What are your relationships like with others? How do you think your time has affected your ability to have more personal relationships?
Well, I'm married and adopted my daughter. I don't know if that's what you're talking about.
Congratulations.
But I can say the reintegration process is a very difficult one. It's one of the things that I actually do counseling with. Like, I've spoken to exonerees. A lot of times when an exoneree gets out, I always usually reach out to the lawyers and I go, hey, listen, if your client wants to talk to somebody who's been through this, you know, have them give me a call, because the transition period, you know, some people think you can transition smoothly back into society, and it's a long process. You know, just from integrating into going shopping. You know, I tell people the story that when I first got out, you know, it took me 3 hours to go to a supermarket. I said my wife would bring me to a store, and you'd go down the cereal aisle, and there's an entire aisle of cereal. When you're in prison, you get three or four choices. So there's this sensory overload just from even food choices, or going to the clothing store, where you're thinking that somebody who's been locked up for 30 years, well, the style of clothing has changed. You know, you may not know how to go. You know, I remember one of the issues I had was when I first got out, I got a credit debit card. And I thought it was actually a credit card, even though it said credit debit card. And I like overdrafted on it. And I was like, what do you mean I overdrafted? It's a credit card. I'll just pay the credit card the monthly payment. Like, no, it's not that. There are so many little things that it is a gradual learning experience that I try to tell exonerees, and even people who haven't exonerated, even people who are guilty who come out, and say, take it slow, take it one day at a time. Do not compare yourself to what someone else has, because what someone else has may have taken them 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. I have a friend who's been out almost 15 years now. He bought himself a studio apartment on the Upper West Side, all on his own. You know, somebody who gets out of prison is going to look at that and go, oh my God, look what you have. Yeah, it took him 12 years to do that though. You know, people are going to look at me and go, you know, look what you have. It took me 10 years to accomplish this. It's not a rapid fire type of reintegration, rehabilitation, socialization issue. You know, it's a learning process. You know, you can, and I've been out with exonerees who still are not fully adjusted to society. And some of them have been out longer than me.
And I'm over here taking notes, because I did 22 years and it's been a year and a half for me. So I'm taking notes.
Listen, it is a very, very long process. You know, and when I tell people, I said, take it slow. It's you know, and I tell people, if one of the best things that for me and I think other exonerees is every now and then we do kind of do this like exoneree for exoneries, where a group of us will go out for dinner or drinks, just to talk, because it enables us to have conversations that nobody's going to be prejudgmental, nobody's going to criticize us, and that everybody's going to understand what we're all talking about.
Do you remember what 16, early 17-year-old Marty Tankleff dreamed about being when he grew up?
Yeah, I do. But in today's day and age, it's embarrassing to say it, but I'll say it anyway. I wanted to be the next...
You wanted to be Batman?
No, I actually wanted to be the next Donald Trump.
Wow.
I want, in the sense of the business sense, like I had a very big business acumen as a kid. And when I was growing up, I saw the level of success he had. And I, you know, my goal was to go to the Wharton School of Business and go and kind of be that successful businessman. And, you know, when I was young, my father was grooming me for business. I had businesses with my father. never wanted to become president. I just wanted to become a very successful businessman.
So how do you think your experience has changed your outlook on life?
Well, I'm a lawyer now, and I go to court and litigate cases and deal with prosecutors and judges. And, you know, I've even had to deal with the prosecutor who fought to keep me in prison for years because he's a sitting Suffolk County judge. So I've appeared before him with my boss. So I've had some very unusual experiences over the last few years.
That is unusual. How did that make you feel?
He actually was my criminal law professor at law school. And it really was a very interesting experience because I had to take his class and I spoke to my lawyers and they were like, just confront him head on. I spoke to some of the criminal law professors and they said, listen, you know, Judge Cohen is not who, you know, Mark Cohen was before. He's different. I met with Judge Cohen. He stuck out his hand. He goes, Mr. Tango, because I welcomed him in the class. And I got an A+ in his class. And it was one of the best classes I ever took.
Okay. All right.
So as a person who, you know, you said you've been out for 10 years and you gave some great advice, you know, take it slow, talk to people. What advice might you have for someone who is still incarcerated or right now being prosecuted for something that they didn't do?
So for those who are incarcerated, the biggest piece of advice I can say is don't give up. Time, a lot of times, is an innocent person's best friend. For example, if you have biological evidence or some type of scientific evidence in your case that may not have been able to be tested 5 years ago, technology may have developed where today it could be tested. You know, there was a Stephen Barnes is a perfect example, New York State exoneree who had evidence in his case that couldn't have been tested, you know, 15 years ago, but all of a sudden touch DNA came out and they used touch DNA to exonerate him. What I would also say is that if you're being prosecuted right now, have an absolutely open line of communication with your defense lawyer. And make sure your defense lawyer is a true advocate. Make sure he goes, the old expression, balls to the wall nonstop. And I say this because one of my lawyers, Bruce Barquette, represented by a man by the name of Nicholas Mars. Nicholas was charged with essentially a shooting of a young boy on, I don't know if it was Easter Sunday. It was a religious holiday while the boy was going to church. From the time Nicholas was arrested, he kept saying, Bruce, I'm innocent, Bruce, I'm innocent, Bruce, I'm innocent. For 2 years, Bruce kept trying to tell the district attorney's office, you have the wrong person, you have the wrong person. The case went to trial. Bruce made his opening statements, and the judge said, after opening statements, said, have you told the line assistant everything you said in court today? Bruce said, I've been trying for 2 years. The judge said, would you consent to a mistrial if I got you a meeting with the Bronx DA? Bruce said, yes. At a meeting with the Bronx DA, 45 days later, the murder indictments were dismissed against Nicholas Morris. I think it was 6 or 7 years later, the gentleman who actually did the shooting was arrested. And that is because the defense lawyer fought nonstop, believed in his client and fought for his client. You know, and if you're innocent, and if you have a lawyer who doesn't believe in you and doesn't fight for you, I would say get a new lawyer. You need a lawyer that's going to fight for you.
And I think a lot of guys don't realize that, you know, they could get rid of that lawyer and go get another lawyer. They feel like they have to keep this lawyer. Yeah.
Right. You have to have good grounds for it. And what I tell people is have a good communication with your lawyer. Okay. And you know what? Document everything. If you have a meeting with your lawyer and you walk away and the lawyer says, you know, I think you're guilty. Well, you know what I would do is I would write a follow-up letter right back to that lawyer and say, you know what? I don't think you can effectively represent me. You think I'm guilty. You know, obviously we don't have a good working relationship. And then at least you have some grounds that when you go to ask the judge for a new lawyer, you go, Your Honor, listen, we just had a meeting. He said he thinks I'm guilty.
So what do you think that someone like me can do, or someone who hasn't been wrongly convicted can do to help people who have?
So there's a few things. So, you know, first of all, educating the public is one of the most important things people can do. And people like you and Jason Flom and the podcast help educate the public, because I think your public becomes your jurors. Your jurors become the judgment people. And if they're educated about problems with the system, they may judge differently. They may not believe everything that they're told in the courtroom, because they know not everything they're told is the truth, because we understand how many lies that have taken place in courtrooms have led to wrongful convictions. People who are looking to help exonerees, one of the things that I do is I work with the Innocence Project as an exoneree advisory board member. And one of the things we're trying to do is create welcome home packages. So for anybody who's working for American Express or Amazon or eBay, we're looking for major sponsors, or even minor sponsors, or even individuals who'd be willing to donate T-shirts, toothpaste, soap for exonerees. We have about approximately 100 exonerees that come home every year, and most of them come home with nothing. So we're looking to create kind of this welcome home package where we can send them a box that has basic necessities that they can at least get their first few months started off with.
So I wanted to end with, I read a quote the other day on Twitter that was attributed to you, and it basically said that you were the member of a club that...
Yeah, I think I'm part of the most honorable club that nobody wants to be a member of.
Right. And I thought that was the most accurate thing that I've ever heard.
It is. It's just like I was joking with a few exonerees who have become lawyers. And I said, we should start the Exoneree Bar Association, that it'll be the smallest bar association that nobody wants to be a part of. But if you are part of it, it is the most honorable position you can hold. And so everybody said, yeah, I think you're right there.
Like Marty, we all been through this, and to see you get out and strive for greatness, basically, I love to see that. It gives me hope. Like, okay, he done it. He's doing it. I'm going to be all right. I just got to take it slow.
It's taking it slow. It's pacing yourself and setting realistic goals.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, I have friends who were guilty, who came out, and they set realistic goals for themselves. And what's interesting about it is one of my friends and I, we had lunch together, a few months ago. And we went to this nice little Thai place. We just sat down and we said, his name was Eric. And I said, do you remember back in like 1993 when we used to say, where were we going to be in 15 years from now or 20 years from now? He goes, yeah, Marty. You said you were going to get out and you were going to become a lawyer. And I said, I was going to get out and become an artist. And both of us are doing exactly what we said. So I think for a lot of guys, when they were in prison, they may have set those goals for when they get out. Guys who get out should strive to achieve them, but realize it's going to take time. And when you need help along the way, don't be afraid to ask for help, whether it be going to see a therapist, whether it be going to ask for job assistance, whether it be asking to help a resume. Everybody needs help at some point in their life. And I think as a society, most of us don't want to see failure. People who have served their time they're back in society, and we want to see them become productive members of society, not fail. And if they need help along the way, we should help them.
My thing is, like, when people get out of prison after so long, I feel like, we people that have been exonerated, if they're in a position or someone, need to help these guys. It's a lot of people coming out of prisons. It seems like each day somebody is, case is overturned.
I'm waiting for the National Registry of Exonerations to come up with a new number. But the other thing, too, is one of the most interesting things is that in New York, I can speak about it from New York, but I don't know about other states. If you're guilty and you get out of prison, you have more services available to you than if you're innocent and you come out of prison. If you're innocent and you don't have family or friends, there's literally no service available for you to help find housing or jobs other than the Innocence Project. The Innocence Project helps you. If you're guilty, Division of Parole, there's so many organizations that's their job to help you. And I think we need to kind of step back and say, we need to do more on the reintegration process. You know, when I was in prison, I came up with this idea, and everybody thought I was crazy. That was that when gentlemen, men and women are about a year away from their release, in whatever state they're in, there should be what I call the transition prison. And the prison should be designed like living in a city, where you give them job training, how to use ATMs, how to drive a car. This way, when people get out, it's not a shock to them. You know, you know how to go to a hotel and all of a sudden there's no key, it's a card. Or you know about, you know, a 401k. You know, you said you did 22 years?
Yes.
Okay. So when you got out, right, did you know about cell phones and ATMs and 401ks? Wouldn't you have been better served if in the last year of your incarceration, you went through a training program where they taught you how to use everything? So when you got out, it wasn't like a deer in headlights. And I think that it would be one of the best national programs that could be instituted. And honestly, in the long run, it would save money. Because if people got out and they knew how to get a job, knew how to write a resume, knew how to use a bank account, they wouldn't go back to committing crime. So they would have some sense of self-worth, some identity, and they knew how to do things.
Marty is doing so well for himself, and he's making a huge difference for others, including his fellow exonerees. And I love the quote that he shared, "I'm in the most honorable group of people that nobody wants to be in." What do you think about that quote?
That quote, I don't know if I could use one word that I guess I'll just say I liked it. I really liked the quote. It was different, and it, you know, it was so true.
So until next time, thank you so much for listening.
Actual Innocence is hosted by DeMarco Carpenter and Brooke Giddings. Our original music is by Blake Maples. Our transcriptionist is Christina Judge. Our website guru is Sean Cole. Our master of social media is Cameron Taylor. And our amazing volunteer is Casey Weber. You can visit our website for bonus materials like transcripts, pictures, and calendars of upcoming episodes.